last year, a judge in Nigeria threw out a case of 47 men that was arrested in a hotel. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they are doing, and I quote, a gay initiation, end quote. So obviously the men said they were having a birthday party, and then, but the case anyway was later dismissed because the prosecutors did not provide evidence, witnesses to the court.
Right.
So is this some of the scenarios that it feels like the homophobia that people are experiencing are mostly from the state or the institution and not necessarily from the public, so to speak?
You know, that's a good question. The Initiative for Equal Rights is one of the main Nigerian LGBT organizations, and they do an assessment of human rights violations that are reported to them every year. And it's a majority of them are perpetrated by the state, if I'm remembering the numbers exactly right, or representatives of the state, so the police and that type of thing. But a large number are perpetrated by members of the public. And that takes two forms. One form is blackmail and extortion. And this is one of the painful ironies. So for sexual and gender minority populations who are already subject to stigma and discrimination, it makes it hard to meet other people from those populations. Certainly for romantic partners, but even if you just want friendship and support and those types of things. So a lot of people use online platforms, which are wonderful because, you know, they cut across geography, they can be reached at different times of day. But it means that people who are looking to basically to prey on sexual and gender minorities can go to those sites and, you know, put in a fake message, say, come meet me at this hotel or meet me at this restaurant. And then when the community member arrives there, you know, they'll be said, well, you know, you pay me money now, or I'm going to tell your family that you're gay, or I'm going to call the police or something like that. So in a survey of men who have sex with men and transgender women from Nigeria, I think about a quarter of the people surveyed had experienced blackmail or extortion in some form. So it's very, very high rates.
This podcast came to be because I want to reignite discussions about Pan-Africanism. And the purpose is to plant seeds of unity and inspiration among Africans, both at home and in the diaspora. I believe we have come to the stage where our continent is more vulnerable than ever, and it's up to us to decide our fate moving forward. What we will come to realize, I hope, is that we're so much more alike than we're different. And this show is just a small contribution to the public discourse that is going on in Africa right now. My name is Soshima Iro, and this is the Pan-African Experience. On today's episode, I'll be talking to Professor Rachel Robinson. Professor Robinson is an associate professor of the School of International Service at American University, Washington, D.C. She holds a PhD in sociology and demography from the University of California at Berkeley. Her research focuses on sex-related health interventions in sub-Saharan Africa, including family planning, HIV/AIDS, and sexuality education. She studies how such interventions come into being, the actors that are involved, such as NGOs, and how they influence one another. Her current project centers on politicized homophobia and the extent of social science knowledge on NGOs. She is the author of the book, Intimate Interventions in Global Health, Family Planning and HIV Prevention in Sub-Saharan Africa. She has published articles in journals such as Demography, Journal of the International AIDS Society, Population Studies, and Population Research and Policy Review. She has conducted field research in Namibia, Malawi, Nigeria, and Senegal. Her research has been funded by the MacArthur Foundation, the Council of American Overseas Research Centers, and the National Science Foundation. Professor Robinson teaches courses on statistics, global health, population studies, development, and NGOs. I am so grateful and honored to have Professor Robinson on the show. And coming up next is the full conversation. Professor Rachel Robinson, welcome to the Pan-African Experience.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to talk to you about LGBT in sub-Saharan Africa. especially in Nigeria. And you've spent a lot of time researching these issues in Nigeria. And I would like to, but before we delve into this, I just wanted to know what inspired you to go into this field of study in the first place?
Great question. So first of all, it was not something that I actually initially started out to study. I'm a sociologist and a demographer. And the question that first brought my interest to sub-Saharan Africa was actually about population policy. So I was curious why on earth would governments of countries in Africa whose populations were largely pronatalist, why would they adopt policies that suggested people should have fewer children? So that question brought me to Nigeria and to Senegal, which have two of the earliest population policies. And from that moment on, I started getting to know the organizations, particularly the non-governmental and community-based organizations working in the reproductive health area. So that led me to work on HIV and looking at the connections between countries' histories of family planning interventions and how those influenced how they responded to the AIDS crisis. And then as a result of that, because men who have sex with men, which is the public health term for what in many places people would identify as gay men, but often do not necessarily identify as such, that work in HIV and the importance of MSM to the HIV epidemic as an at-risk population led me to get to know organizations working in support of LGBT populations. Again, particularly in Nigeria.
Okay. Oh, that's really good. Obviously, the you're very familiar with Nigeria, as I said, and the Same-Sex Prohibition Act, which was ratified by President Jonathan Goodluck, the then president, in 2014, and this criminalized same-sex marriages and a same-sex relationship. And you have done extensive research on this. Can you elaborate on this, please?
Yeah. First, let me back up a little bit by saying that same-sex sexuality is criminalized in most sub-Saharan African countries already, and that was the case in Nigeria. And it's really interesting. So it has colonial roots in terms of inheritance from the British Penal Code, but then also borrowing from the Indian Criminal Code. I mean, there's a fascinating legal history. Legal history is there. But so just to be clear, prior to the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act, it was not that same-sex sexuality was legal in Nigeria. So this was something that was put on top of already existing rules. And perhaps the most concerning part, one interesting part, there was no agitation within Nigeria for same-sex marriage. So the law came from several different places. One is that there had been a move within the global Anglican community towards recognizing same-sex marriage. And it turned out that the primate of the Nigerian Anglican Church ended up leading the sort of global opposition to this. So that was going on at the same time. South Africa had legalized same-sex marriage. So there's something else happening on the continent. But there was no demand. There was no demand for this. And then there were also political roots as well. So President Jonathan was running for re-election. He was not doing terribly well. His party was splintering. And some have argued that his support for this bill, which had been working its way in various forms actually through the Nigerian legislature since as early as 2006 and 2007, his support for it was really just kind of a ploy to get support from voters. So the law was passed. And the main thing that it did was it sort of gave legal license to people, to average sort of everyday Nigerians, as well as the police, to act out against LGBT Nigerians. So it sort of brought the issue to the fore. So there was a lot of coverage in the media. And the law in particular also directly violates Nigeria's constitution in terms of clauses about freedom of association, because it prohibits organizations that work in support of same-sex loving communities. And so it has some severe ramifications for organizing as well as for just treatment of LGBT people. So immediately following its enactment, there were increases in violence against the LGBT community. And there are also many people were afraid to go seek out healthcare. So just everyday healthcare, but also certainly sexual healthcare related to HIV and sexually transmitted infections. That situation, at least in terms of healthcare seeking, improved somewhat over time, but there's still, you know, quite a bit of violence by police and family members against the LGBT community.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Jonathan was running for re-election at the time, and obviously there's a political element to homophobia. And usually when governments or think that's what the public want, you know, this is something that you guys looked into as well. Did you, you spoke to LGBT organizations in Nigeria and the communities? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, if there's one message that I would like to have come across, it's that, you know, Africans are not inherently homophobic, the same as people nowhere are people homophobic. It's often something that comes about because of politicization of the topics. And so, you know, scholars have used the term politicized homophobia to describe this. So when a politician is in a moment of stress, and that can come in two forms in particular. So one, they may be running for election and it's not going so well, or they wanna, you know, rustle up support. But the other is that it really starts to get into issues between African countries and their donors. So there's a huge amount of pressure coming from donor organizations in the global north to support human rights. And on the one hand, you know, this makes complete sense. We want human rights, we support human rights for different people, but it ends up causing a lot of leaders to dig in their heels and say, you can't tell me what to do. My country was, you know, suffered years and decades of colonial subjugation. Who are you to tell me what to do? So a lot of times this very well-meaning messaging from afar can lead to real backlash. And LGBT organizations get stuck in the middle of this. So like all NGOs and CBOs, they're heavily dependent on foreign funding. Even more so the ones that support LGBT communities, because there's not as much support from within countries. And so they have to walk this delicate line between relying on foreign funders, but really, you know, risking their authenticity as, you know, representatives of whatever country they're coming from, and, you know, facing a lot of criticism about who are you? Are you just doing this? Are you just doing this for the money? Do you really believe this? Those types of discourses they have to deal with.
Last year, a court judge in Nigeria threw out a case of 47 men that was arrested in a hotel. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
And they say they're doing, and I quote, a gay initiation, end quote. So obviously the men said they were having a birthday party, and then, but the case anyway was later dismissed because the prosecutors did not provide evidence. Witnesses to the court.
Right.
So is this some of the scenarios that it feels like the homophobia that people are experiencing are mostly from the state or the institution and not necessarily from the public, so to speak?
You know, that's a good question. The Initiative for Equal Rights is one of the main Nigerian LGBT organizations. And they do an assessment of human rights violations that are reported to them every year. And it's a majority of them are perpetrated by the state, if I'm remembering the numbers exactly right, or representatives of the state, so the police and that type of thing. But a large number are perpetrated by members of the public. And that takes two forms. One form is blackmail and extortion. So, and this is one of the painful ironies. So for sexual and gender minority populations who are already subject to stigma and discrimination, it makes it hard to meet other people from those populations. Certainly for romantic partners, but even if you just want friendship and support and those types of things. So a lot of people use online platforms, which are wonderful because, you know, they cut across geography, they can be reached at different times of day. But it means that people who are looking to basically to prey on sexual and gender minorities can go to those sites and, you know, put in a fake message, say, come meet me at this hotel or meet me at this restaurant. And then when the community member arrives there, you know, they'll be said, well, you know, you pay me money now, or I'm going to tell your family that you're gay, or I'm going to call the police or something like that. So in a survey of men who have sex with men and transgender women from Nigeria, I think about a quarter of the people surveyed had experienced blackmail or extortion in some form. So it's very, very high rates. The other form that it takes is, of course, not everyone's family members are supportive. And so again, many LGBT organizations across sub-Saharan Africa, I know best the ones in Nigeria, but they've published stories and testimonials written by sexual and gender minority members of those populations in order sort of for two things. One, to counter narratives of there's no such thing as a homosexual African, to say, no, you know, I'm Nigerian, I'm gay or whatever. But also to help build solidarity within their communities. And when you read those, you know, there's heartbreaking stories of, you know, abuse suffered from at the hands of family members, countered, however, by supportive family members as well. So that was a long way of answering that. I mean, I think the takeaway from that is that, again, it's not a universal atmosphere of homophobia, and much of what happens as homophobia, you know, it may be people trying just to make money as well in terms of extortion and blackmail, and that there are pockets of support that people do have access to.
And I have to say, you know, I was born in Nigeria and I grew up in Nigeria, and at least in my area, the Southeast, where I grew up, there were not a lot of gay people, LGBT community that I'm aware of, you know. Mm-hmm. And now I can understand they could have been, but, you know, they're not maybe afraid to come out, you know, something like that. And I've had a personal experience with regards to this, because I have a cousin, he has passed away now, a male cousin who has passed away. And we were raised in a Catholic home, you know, when in America people always say, oh, I was raised in the church. We were practically raised in the church, because we have to go to mm-hmm. mass every day and then go to the mass on Sunday, but still go to mass Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, all day. So a large percentage of my time was spent in the church when I was young, growing up. So this, my cousin fell sick and he passed away. But before he passed away, my mom was telling me this now. He, almost like confession, he told my mom that, you know, he's gay, and he was sad and asking my mom if he's going to go to hell. You know, this is almost at the point. And this made me really, really, really sad, you know. And my mom didn't even tell me this until maybe two, three years after he passed away. You know, can you imagine? And I never knew, you know, we went to the same school, we played together, we do most things together, and I wasn't even aware, you know. I felt so sad that it wasn't comfortable enough to, you know, to come out and speak to someone. And he didn't even speak to his own mom, you know, because he's mm-hmm. my cousin. So that made me to start to have an interest, because, you know, the Catholic background, you know, Catholicism don't like homosexual, you know, community. Maybe it's changing now a little bit, but that's the doctrine. And so that's what made me starting to look into, you know, the LGBT community, just trying to, you know, educate myself more, trying to find out more. Maybe, you know, I don't want to blame myself, but I'm thinking, is there something I could have done more, but he was loved by the family because he never really mentioned anything about homosexuality. Even if he mentioned homosexuality, he would still be loved, but for some reason, maybe he didn't feel, you know, comfortable to say that. So I'm assuming there will be thousands of people like him in Nigeria, mm-hmm. you know.
No, I think your assumption is absolutely correct. And thank you for sharing that story. It makes me think of several things. One is that, of course, again, as you point out, most Nigerians almost certainly know someone who is gay. They just may not know that. And because a large majority of men who have sex with men, for example, are married. And you know, the pressure to marry and have children for average Nigerians is extraordinarily high. And so it becomes very difficult to stay single. And it's very difficult in particular if you don't have children. But what that means, the fact that most people probably know someone, is that each little crack in making it possible for people to talk to someone helps increase then the number of people who know someone who is out even just a little bit. And that can help, I think, sort of tip the dominoes towards more openness. That is very much what happened incredibly rapidly in the United States in terms of support for gay marriage. More and more people began to know that they had a cousin, they had a friend, they had some other family member who was gay, and it becomes much, much harder to sort of blanket say, I don't like those people, I don't want to include those people when you know someone. So that definitely, you know, can play a real role. The other thing, it made me think of some of the creative ideas that organizations have had in terms of, well, you know, what do you do in order to help make the average Nigerian more comfortable with the fact that, no, you know, gay people exist, there are these different communities. One main strategy is through visual media. So the TIRS, the same organization I mentioned before, one of Nigeria's main LGBT organizations, they produce Nollywood style dramas that have gay characters. And they're not the only character. So the key point is that there's all of the different characters. And so they're just in there in the mix. And so it's just, it makes it something much more normal. And there's increasingly, you know, more high profile people are starting to come out, and that can help in terms of, well, if it's a celebrity who did it, you know, then that's, that can make it more, sort of to help tip the dominoes.
Yeah. Normalize it to normalize. Yeah.
But there's other ideas too. I mean, one, you know, when you think about an entire part of the population that is not able to live up to their full potential, you know, that has economic ramifications. So one organization that we had spoken with, you know, they said, wow, I'd really like to calculate what the economic impacts of discrimination against sexual minorities is. I'm sure it's huge. And for a country that is trying to develop and has a lot of impoverished people, you know, that might be a convincing way to, you know, help somebody understand more. It's like, no, we need to include everyone. So that's the parallel to, yes, we need to include women in development. And yes, we need to include, you know, sexual and gender minorities in development as well.
Yeah, and I don't want it to look like I'm criticizing Africa, because this homophobia is not specific to Africa or Nigeria. But what gets me angry to some extent is that, you know, this is a country where, you know, criminals are beheading people almost on a daily basis, and police are using their resources going to hotels looking for gay people. Do you know what I mean? The priority is slightly skewed for me. So that's where it gets me angry a little bit. You mentioned men. Do you want to say something? Please go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think Nigerians should be angry about, absolutely. And what I think it speaks to, of course, again, it's the same thing. It's a cheap political trick to call your opponent gay, or to, you know, just the same as it's a lot easier for the police, unfortunately, to go round up people at a birthday party than to solve more systematic issues that relate to poverty and insecurity that are just much harder to address. So yes, I mean, and that's part of why that happens, but the people should be mad about that because Nigerians really care about security too. I mean, and that's, I mean, that's one of their prime concerns at this point. And so, yeah, don't go arrest gay people. Like, go figure out how to stop kidnapping.
Definitely. Definitely. You mentioned men who have sex with men. Is this a new phrase, a new phrase in the maybe LGBTQ phraseology, or
it's actually kind of an old phrase, and it is very much, it's from public health. So if with the idea being that if you talk about a gay identity, well, so first of all, there's the idea that identities are chosen. So we can say, you know, I identify as a woman, I identify as straight, whatever it is, how I identify. Whereas the idea of using the MSM is that it focuses on the behavior of a man having sex with another man. And the idea then being that it destigmatizes somewhat, so that with the very real, you know, idea that if you went to a country where there's a great deal of stigma and discrimination against sexual and gender minorities, and you just ask someone on a public health survey, are you gay? They would probably say, no, I'm not gay. I don't identify as gay. But if you say, you know, did you have sex with a man in the last year? Many of those people would then say yes. And so it came from that. What is interesting is that I know, at least in the case of Cote d'Ivoire, some LGBT groups have sort of reappropriated the term to refer to themselves as MSM, as a category that's meaningful. But for the most part, it's within the public health lexicon.
Okay, in your research, you highlighted the almost like the consequence of inclusion of men who have sex with men in the global response to HIV/AIDS. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah. So, first of all, it's kind of there's sort of two streams. So, if you don't know the history of HIV, so it kind of emerged in the early 1980s as a global epidemic. And the way that it was experienced in the global north was primarily with an association with gay men and with groups of men who identified as gay. So it was very much actually seen as a gay disease in the north. In the global south and in sub-Saharan Africa, it was general population. So it was everybody who was getting HIV. So then there was sort of this bifurcation of, well, HIV in Africa is everyone, so it's heterosexuals, but in the north it's gay people. And this was, you know, really sort of foolhardy, of course, because again, there are same-sex loving individuals everywhere, but so as a result, the idea of, and just one biological side note, the risk of HIV transmission is much higher for two men having unprotected sex than it is for a man and a woman having unprotected sex. So there's that biological reality of easier transmissibility of HIV. But so then as a result, gay people in Africa and same-sex living people in Africa just got overlooked in the epidemic. And it wasn't then until really kind of early 2000s, you know, 20 to 25 years into the HIV epidemic, and this is good work that my co-author Tara McKay has done, that sort of re-entered into the global response to HIV, which sort of like, oh, there's men having sex with men, and they're getting HIV at extraordinarily high rates. So as a result, then more money started going towards that group, which was good because they needed it. They were at high risk. But it made that population much more visible to broader communities. So all of a sudden, when the National AIDS Commission starts talking about, well, we have this program for men who have sex with men, people are like, oh, I didn't know we had those people there. And so the good thing about that is for a lot of men who are having sex with men, they're like, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. There are other people. So there's research, for example, from Senegal showing an increase in the number of men belonging to associations, for example. And so that's fantastic. That's people coming together and supporting one another. But there is also backlash as a result of it. So very real backlash and politicized homophobia from political leaders. And in the paper that you're referring to with Tara McKay and Nicole Angadi, my co-authors, we show that that happened in both Senegal and Nigeria following sort of very prominent moments of visibility that came about as a result of responses to HIV.
I was wondering if women who have sex with women, the treatment is more lenient than men who have sex with men. Because without data, just from anecdote, you know, I think maybe globally, women who have sex with women are more treated more lenient, or you know, not as harsh as men who have sex with men. What do you think, from your research, did you find any disparities in this?
Yeah, so no, it's such an interesting question. So certainly legally, so for example, if you look at Sharia law in Northern Nigeria, which has, you know, allows death by stoning in some places for men who have been caught having sex with another man, the penalty is not as harsh for women, for example. So just that's an example of the phenomenon you just described. And for whatever reason, and this is not my area of expertise, but I do think that women having sex with women is much less threatening than men having sex with men. And, you know, for example, for, you know, women who are gay can marry and have children, and so they can fulfill social roles much to some degree somewhat easier than a man who is gay. And so that I think also makes a coexistence, which is not necessarily a good one, but makes it so that some women can kind of find a path forwards. But this is an area, I mean, there's so much more research on men, LGBT men, than on LGBT women. And that definitely needs to be changed. And part of that is because so much of the research was funded by and encouraged by and related to HIV transmission, that then produced more research. But of course, there's lesbians all over Africa, and but much less is known about them. They have fewer organizations supporting them, and that has to do with things related to gender bias. So there's they often suffer from, you know, they could or should be aligned with broader LGBT movements, but there's gender divides within those that disadvantage the organizations supporting lesbians. And then, but they often then suffer in terms of they can't join with the broader women's movement because they're discriminated against for their sexuality. And so it's a hard path for the organizations that support women, but they do exist. And the big organizations could do more to support women as well. It's not just men.
Okay, so go ahead.
I'll just add one more thing, sorry. Yeah. For people who identify as transgender, they very much fall through the cracks in terms of there's transphobia, and there's even fewer organizations in support of them than women. And so that's another area in need of much greater attention.
Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about sexual health education, specifically in Nigeria. How was the current state of that? Because even the general health is not as attainable to the less privileged. Obviously, people that have a lot of money in Nigeria have access to good healthcare, even in Nigeria. But people mm-hmm. that do not have a lot of money, the less privileged, do not even have access to general healthcare, let alone, you know, sexual healthcare and education. So what is the state of that, and how is that going?
So it's very interesting. So Nigeria has a national sexuality education curriculum. It came into being because of hard work and advocacy by sexual and reproductive health advocates located in Lagos, in particular, one organization called Action Health Incorporated. And they helped translate existing sex ed curriculum for the Nigerian context, and were able to get it passed at the national level as, you know, and then adopted as a national curriculum. So it is called, but there is a but, of course. It got there were a lot of compromises along the way. And this is something that I found to be true about sexuality education the world over. Usually there's so many compromises made that what you are left with at the end of the day, it can be difficult to, it's hard to know how much of an effect it will have. But so it is called the Family Life and HIV Education Curriculum, the FLHE. Did you get this when you went to school?
No, not at all. No.
So of course, if you went to a Catholic school, it wouldn't be bound by the same rules. But just note the HIV in the title. So this was one of the things that helped win over conservatives who were disinclined against incorporating the curriculum. They were concerned about the spread of HIV, and so that helped. But then the curriculum got further changed. So in the North, lots and lots of the material was actually explicitly changed. So they went through the curriculum and took out pictures. They took out references. So the word sexuality was replaced with the word humanity in many cases. So I was actually looking at the curriculum and I was reading it. And I don't understand. This doesn't make this word. What does this mean? And then I found out that they had replaced the word humanity throughout. At the same time, even despite what I just said about, you know, who knows what the education actually looks like, with sexuality education, I think what really matters is the person who's giving it in the classroom. So you could be in the most conservative context and it could be the most terrible curriculum ever. But if the person teaching the class is someone who students will talk to and ask questions of, and if the person will answer them with good information and support the students, they will still be well served. So what students need are, you know, caring adults who are willing to answer their questions. But these curricula, I mean, it's better to have it than not. And it has important pieces about like negotiation and overcoming, you know, gender stereotypes and those types of things. But yeah, Nigeria, they does have a curriculum, and many other countries do this with sort of kind of similar, I think, similar stories in terms of how they came into being.
And the funny thing, or not so funny thing, is that in the northern part of Nigeria, is mostly Muslims. And I know people that live there, and they will tell me, even though as conservative as it is, there are more people, more men having sex with men in the north. Mm. But yet, the opposition to homosexuality, you know, because obviously the president now is a Muslim from the north. But so I find it very bizarre. Even you see similar trends, maybe in America, the conservatives or people that are pushing anti-gay laws, or those pastors that are trying to pray the gay away, ends up being gay. You know, it's not like, it's not outing them, but just observing the hypocrisy is very sad to see.
Oh yeah, and I mean, you know, bad feelings about homosexuality held by homosexual, I mean, that's a very real thing, and that comes from that pervasive climate of homophobia and anti-homosexuality, and makes it much harder for people who struggle, yeah, who are struggling. It is, there's, you know, most Nigerians are very religious. And so for those who come out openly as gay, they're often in their personal testimonials, their stories of how to reconcile that with their faith and with, you know, very religious members of their family. It's quite a journey. The House of Rainbow is one organization that has, you know, an explicit religious orientation in Nigeria. And so, you know, there's efforts then to create affirming spaces that are still Christian. I actually don't know if there's any Muslim ones. That's an interesting question, but they do exist. But yes, the intersections with religion can be difficult for people.
Yeah. So I was wondering if there has been an upsurge in homophobia in Nigeria. And I say that because the more work people like you do, the more work the NGOs in Nigeria do, that will prompt more visibility, right? And with more visibility, there will be more homophobia, I will assume. Has there been an upsurge, you think, from what you do?
So I actually think the situation is improving slightly. And that I'm basing that on Tears, the organization in Lagos. They have done sort of regular surveys of nationally representative samples of Nigerians that still show overwhelmingly negative attitudes towards homosexuality, but which have improved slightly over time. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there has been an improvement. And I think there's two things going on. First is, I do get the sense that a lot of Nigerians, particularly urban educated ones, are willing to take the stance of, maybe I'm not comfortable with it, I don't know if I like it, but if somebody's doing it in their own home in private, I don't care. Like, they should be able to do what they want to do. And that was what happened in the US as well. And I do think there's probably that. But then I think there's the other thing that we were talking about before, which is that, I mean, if you ask Nigerians about what they are most concerned about, they're going to say security and the economy and corruption. And sure, if you ask them explicitly about homosexuality, they'll have an opinion, but it is not at the top of the list.
Speak to people that are people that I consider good people. You know, they're philanthropic. They help people in the community. But when I talk to them about homosexuality, to get a sense of, you know, what is going on, they always oppose it, you know, and they oppose it based on a religious ground. They say, oh, you know, this is not acceptable, you know, by God, or they quote a Bible specifically that says, you know, same-sex relationship shouldn't happen, or same-sex sexual relationship shouldn't happen. And I think the most difficult hurdle to overcome is the religious one. And for some reason, in most African countries, especially in Nigeria, religion and culture has been intertwined. You know, it's almost difficult to separate them.
I think that's true everywhere. I mean, religion is part of culture, and absolutely. I guess what to say about that. So there are great examples of, you know, openly gay Nigerians who are also very religious. So there is that, and I think that can help set an example. But I think that is where sort of a bottom up change in terms of, so yes, the Bible or the Quran, it says not to do a lot of things that people already do, right? So not everybody follows it perfectly. So why focus on this one particular one? And you know, why not instead demonstrate all of the other virtues of a good Christian or a good Muslim, and sort of say that's unrelated to my sexuality or to the sexuality of someone else. And I mean, this is something that organizations supporting LGBT populations have tried to do. So they've tried to demonstrate their members engaging in good Christian activities. And, you know, another way of using kind of positive visibility in terms of saying, like, yeah, we're, you know, there's one example of an organization, you know, they went to an orphanage, they had a good relationship with the orphanage in terms of supporting the children. And this is, you know, a classic example of something that would be viewed as a charitable work, regardless of religious faith.
And I think that's where the sexual education comes into play, because I would think that when people hear gay relationship, or, you know, they always think of sex. You know, in heterosexual relationship, when you say, oh, this is my wife or my girlfriend, nobody thinks of sex straight away. You know, they think about the relationship, how's it being a husband, is it a good wife or good girlfriend, are they, you know, raising their kids well? So, but what I've noticed is that people tend to go straight to sex when it comes to gay relationships. You know, which I find very, very strange.
Yeah, and that is a great observation, and it's very interesting to think about a communication campaign that used that to help people, again, to think about LGBT community members as people first, and then as, you know, their sexuality, you know, second. And that is, I mean, this has been a struggle. The broader human rights community within Nigeria has not always been very welcoming towards LGBT organizations. I mean, just in terms of talking about divides within civil society. And so there's benefits to more universal principles in terms of, well, no, everybody's human. Everybody should have the right to associate and should have the right to, you know, freedom from violence and those types of things. But those are tools that have not been used, I think, as much and could potentially be usefully applied.
So in June last year, you know, Botswana overturned colonial era laws which criminalize homosexuality, and the judge Michael Leburu, you know, said, I quote, "The anti-sodomy laws are a British import and were developed without consultation of local people," end quote. So I would like you to maybe talk a little bit about the background of the colonial origins of these laws.
All right, let's see. Hopefully I can get this right. So first of all, it has to do with also with the timing of colonialism in particular. So it is my understanding that anti-sodomy elements of British law were not always part of British law, but they were added to the British Penal Code around the time that colonization started. So it's just like a terrible accident of timing. But then, of course, most colonies inherited the penal codes or the criminal codes of their colonial masters. And this is as true of former French colonies as it is of former British colonies. So there's at the root of it then is sort of moral panics about different types of sex in European countries in the 19th century, with the French criminal codes not having sort of the anti-sodomy clause per se, and requiring more sort of catching people in the act. So the laws in former French colonies are not quite as, I don't know, kind of restrictive or not quite as extreme. So then when African countries became independent, I mean, I can't fault them for this. It's hard to write an entire criminal code when you're, you know, and so it would have taken a lot of effort not to sort of just build from what was already there. But as a result, sort of things that came from other places just got baked into the systems. But I think that framing of we didn't choose this, why should we still have it, is a productive one. And if you could join it with other parts of the criminal code that perhaps a broader portion of the population don't like, I don't know what that would be, but that's often a good way if you could piggyback sort of getting rid of the anti-sodomy clause while simultaneously getting rid of some other part of the penal code, I don't know, about taxation or something that has broader, you know, broader appeal, and say, yeah, let's get rid of this part. You know, this wasn't our history. We didn't choose this. This doesn't benefit us. Let's get rid of it.
And I hope I will get to see more African countries, you know, follow suit to try to remove any laws to criminalize homosexuality, because I will think there's more important, you know, legislation that needs to be done to make the countries better.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is, there have been legal efforts in Nigeria to try to overturn the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act in particular. Again, because it obviously and in many different ways violates the Constitution. But one of the fascinating instances, one of the first suits that was brought against it was turned down by a judge because the plaintiff was themselves not gay. And so was viewed as it couldn't possibly affect them. And so, I mean, it's just, and it's difficult to get judges to take the cases because of the stigma associated with it. I mean, just coming back to what you were saying earlier about people are sort of quick to say like, oh, my religion doesn't let me, you know, be supportive of gay rights. People are very concerned about if they, you know, do anything that shows support for gay rights, that they themselves will be seen as being gay. And this is true for straight people who work for LGBT organizations, for, you know, political supporters. It's risky. And that's, I mean, I think that's why I derive a lot of hope from looking at all the organizations that are doing this work, both, you know, with LGBT community members, but also with allies who work with them.
I mean, so far, I think you mentioned Action Health Incorporated and the House of Rainbows. Are there other organizations, LGBT organizations in Nigeria that people should be aware of in case?
Yeah, so actually Action Health Incorporated would not identify probably as an LGBT organization. They're more of a reproductive health and education.
Reproductive health, okay.
So yeah, so Tears in Lagos is probably the biggest, and they have a wonderful website that has lots of resources. So for any listeners who are searching for resources, they have legal resources. They offer, you know, paralegal support to people. They have, I believe they have online counseling. So mental health is a huge issue in the LGBT community. Again, all that stigma and discrimination is not good for mental health. Mental health is hugely, you know, under cared for across the world, but particularly for sexual and gender minorities, that's a big issue. So Tears in Lagos, and then in Abuja, the main organization is called ICAR, which is the International Center for Advocacy on Right to Health. And both of these organizations run clinics where members of the LGBT community can get services. The main lesbian supporting organization in Nigeria is called WHER, W-H-E-R. Another organization in Nigeria, they're called Equality Triangle now. Their name was Queer Alliance before. And let's see. Those are some of the main ones. And what I will just point out is that note that none of those organizations have gay or lesbian or LGBT in their names. And this is part of what those organizations do in order to keep themselves and their constituents safe. And in fact, there's one organization that has been trying to get registered and has repeatedly had their registration turned down because of their title. By the Corporate Affairs Commission in Nigeria. So the naming of organizations, many of these organizations don't have visible signs. They can be tricky to find. So those are some of the main organizations, but there's probably about 25 organizations across Nigeria, which
wow,
is not very
that's
many.
Good. Yeah, okay.
But for a population of, you know, 200 million people, and they're located predominantly in, you know, in major cities. So there's, but there are a lot of online resources, and those are really good, particularly now as more people have, you know, smartphones, and you just have to be careful in the online space.
Is there any other project that is going on, or any other thing you would like to highlight with regards to this area?
No, I mean, there's a lot of needs. And so depending on people's skill, you know, for Nigerians wanting to be involved as allies, for example, or Africans in other countries wanting to be allies, I would definitely, you know, seek out the main organization, LGBT organization in your country, and just learn about things in your community. And then, you know, try to make it such that if somebody wanted to come out to you, they could. And that means, you know, not trying to make stereotypical comments, and, you know, maybe making some supportive comments, or, you know, just thinking about how you present LGBT issues. So that's one thought. But there's also a lot of need for more research. I mean, HIV remains a very significant risk for men who have sex with men. So in Nigeria, the estimated population prevalence of HIV is probably just about 1% or maybe 1.3%. For men who have sex with men, it's in the 40s. So one estimate is at 44%. Wow. So that's, and you know, and so that means that we need research that looks at making sure that what are effective strategies for making it so that people who feel stigmatized can still go to health clinics and get good care, good service? How do you make sure that the media doesn't sensationalize LGBT issues when they report on it? How do you ensure that the police are trained to support, you know, survivors of intimate partner violence from a same-sex partner that get reported? There's just a lot of shifts that can happen. And they, of course, will be easier to happen as if other problems can be addressed. So again, coming back to this issue of, well, if corruption is rife, then yes, people are going to extort and blackmail and things like that. But if you can start to solve issues with corruption, it makes it better for everyone.
Well, thank you very much. I think we've covered pretty much, and this is very informative, you know, and this hopefully, once I edit this, I'm going to put the website, and I will look for more websites and more resources to put in, just in case people want to access
them. I'll send you, no, and I appreciate that. I'll definitely send you the links for different organizations. That would be fantastic to be able to use this as, you know, as outreach.
Okay, I feel like, you know, the more education we get across, the more we can normalize, you know, same-sex relationship, at least to have, you know, maybe the person that's going to change Nigeria will be a gay person, you know? So
yeah.
We don't really know. So we have to make sure that everybody's mental health is in a good place so that we don't know who is going to make the most impact in the country. And right. If it's someone that the country is marginalized or, you know, treating in a very bad way, they might not have the potential, the capacity to realize their full potential, you know? And that's a net negative for the country.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Professor Rachel Robinson, thank you very much for coming on this show.
Thank you for having me. And I was so excited to get to talk to you. So good luck with the overall with the show.